This is the Humboldt Chronicles.
I am the queen of everything. Gotta be high before I can sway. Light a tea and let it be. If you a viper.
My name is Larry Trask, and on behalf of co-producer and host Chuck Rogers, we wish you a very happy holidays, and thank you for listening to this month's edition of the Humboldt Chronicles. A big word of thanks to our sponsors, without whom the Chronicles would not exist. Thank you to Eco Groovy Deals in Arcata, Satori Wellness, Sensa Valley, Humboldt Patient Resource Center, Heart of Humboldt, and the Humboldt County Collective. Thank you, folks. You guys are great. Tonight's episode is going to be a look back at some Humboldt Chronicles episodes that have aired over the past 14 months. That's how long we've been doing this. 14 months, and we're going to start at the very beginning, our very first show from October of 2017, in which we try to trace the foundation of the connection between cannabis and Humboldt County. Here's host Chuck Rogers introducing the topic.
Why here? Why this part of this state? What set of circumstances made it happen here? To find out, we're going to go back to San Francisco in the 1960s.
It qualifies as a mass migration, tens of thousands of kids, mostly 25 and under, heading to San Francisco in the mid to late 1960s, walking away from society's precast molds that they were supposed to pour their lives into, be shaped by, and just accept.
I started in the hippie scene in 64. I was 19. I left home because during my life there were certain incidents that happened that upset this American balance, middle class balance, where everything is just so. Graduate from school, go to college, get a job, raise a family, visit the in-laws, you know, a roundabout thing like that. Well, too many things happened to upset that, to show that that wasn't real.
There to see it all was Robert Thoman, now of McKinleyville, but in San Francisco in the 60s after a tour in the military.
Somebody offered me to trade some hash for my Boda bag, which had some really good wine in it, and I was about to trade that for some hash. And my idea of hash was something that you got in a can, and it had meat and potatoes in it, you know? That's all I knew about hash in 1968. I was introduced to marijuana. I enjoyed it. It wasn't a big thing. It was, you know, not a lot different than drinking a beer or smoking a cigarette or something. I mean, it was kind of fun what it did, but it wasn't all that potent at the time. Most of it came from Mexico.
Issues started cropping up in 68, 69. The Summer of Love was a really unique time in American history, and in San Francisco history, in particular, Bay Area.
That's archaeologist Nick Angeloff, who grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area and who has made a study of the 1960s in the Bay Area and the migration northward.
Folks lived a commune type of lifestyle in the middle of the city. That started breaking down. There was starting to be excessive drug use. The impacts of having fun and living free started to occur in an urban environment. So there was a big move in the end to get away from the urban environment and move into a rural environment. Well, started in Sonoma, that wasn't nearly as populated back then, goes up to Mendocino, and then comes up to Humboldt County, even as far as Oregon. But Humboldt County really was the destination location. And initially, it was what I call the counterculture. Counterculture movement, the back-to-landers, the homesteaders. They grouped together in commune-type of scenarios and started trying to make a living off the land.
There comes a time.
Robert Thoman found his way to Humboldt from the Bay Area in 1970. He's glad he made it here, but he and others like him didn't exactly find a welcoming party waiting.
I moved up here, and the atmosphere was quite different. I mean, if you walked into a bar or a hardware store even, you'd hear a lot of nasty comments made about dirty hippies and skinny dipping at Clam Beach or whatever. There was always some kind of complaints about these people that were moving in. Marijuana was available. You could buy a pound for $100, or you could buy a brick. That was 2.2 pounds. That was a kilo. That was about $200. And you could cut it up into ounces and sell it for $10, and everybody's real happy to get it for $10, and you got to keep some yourself for free.
But at this time, it's not a huge business.
Oh, no, not at all. No, you had to go around and find somebody. Nobody was growing it.
Tell me about the locals and how they received people coming here in the 60s, 70s.
Yeah, the people that worked in the logging industry were not at all friendly towards the people, for the kids especially, the hippie-looking kids, because they threatened their jobs. The lumber companies continued to tell them that the reason they were losing their jobs was because of these kids, even though they were putting people out of jobs by making more automated things, but it was easy to blame it on the hippies. So they were very hostile towards the hippies. It was uncomfortable for a while.
So you did feel some of that?
Oh, yeah, I definitely felt some of it, because I had not real long hair, but I had longer hair, and I was obviously not one of them.
Yeah.
So
you felt some us and them kind of thing?
Yeah, a little bit of friction. The thing is, once you got acquainted with them, they were very nice people. And once they realized that you were just a human being like them, that was not a problem. But it's grown a lot. Humboldt County's grown a lot, and that's made it a little bit nicer.
Comes a time. As things changed, Nick Angeloff points out that some local ranch owners and landowners agreed to sell or lease some of their land to the newcomers.
Isolation, land's cheap. Back then, the logging industry had significant amounts of land that they were basically just giving away at that point. So it was easy to get into land here. Ranchers were amenable to having people come up and buy a plot of land. A very, very rural community. Hard to get to as well. And the roads weren't as good as they are today, but they're okay. The logging industry had developed some roads. So it was a unique spot. People could get out of the way. They could go into the backwoods. Some of the most rural places in the United States are in Humboldt County. And they could live a lifestyle that they dreamed of in the summer of love.
Comes a time. What we've heard so far is that there were a lot of kids in San Francisco. Things got a little sideways there. People started moving north. A lot of them ended up in this area, Humboldt, Mendocino, Trinity, kind of all over this particular area. At the same time, at around 1970, the Controlled Substance Act classified marijuana as Schedule I. With, as we know, heroin and LSD and cocaine and meth and a whole lot of other things. At about that same time, U.S. and Mexico were starting to spray paraquat, which is a toxin, on the pot fields in Mexico. That was going on. Because of the paraquat, some folks in this area said, well, we don't want that. Maybe we should have a couple of plants or something. So they did and got kind of good at it. And at some point, they figured out even how to get the seeds out, creating Sensimilla. So all of these things come together in roughly the same period of time. And so that creates, maybe inadvertently from the government standpoint, a market for Humboldt County pot.
From my perspective, at least, what I call the counterculture era realized that marijuana could be used to make a living. And then we start seeing smaller scale folks basically commercializing cannabis.
Mm-hmm. And figuring out that, hey, we can either supplement what we're doing, or maybe at some point, maybe this was a gradual thing ramping up over time, maybe we can make just a huge living on this.
Absolutely. And then we come into the 80s.
Yeah, the term homegrown, was the marketing in the 70s because of the paraquat,
right.
Because of a number of items. Everybody was selling Colombia. Nobody admitted to it being Mexican. Mm-hmm. And Gentry Anders, who is a local historian, writes about the fact that that a lot of the people who came up were grad students. A lot of people were very well educated. So at some point, somebody probably some botany major somewhere, and we hear different stories about who did it first, learned that if you separate the male and female plants, that the female plant, sort of a sexually frustrated plant, becomes very powerful, and the potency went up you know, overnight. At the same time in the 1980s, you had the federally funded eradication projects that came in. Yeah. The risk became higher, the price got higher, and a lot of people talk about how the community changed.
Nancy Reagan, Just Say No, all the helicopters, growing up in southern Humboldt in the 80s and 90s, some of what Hezekiah Allen remembers.
You know, I remember one summer, I guess it would have been 92, because it was the same year that we had the earthquakes. You know, there were four military helicopters, and one of them parked over the house and, you know, is hovering there. And, of course, we have scanner radios, so we can hear them talking. And, you know, my little brother, my mother, and myself, and Mom loads us into the car, and we're driving away, and we can hear them on the scanner. Oh, look, they're running. They must have something to hide, you know. Shopper Bravo, follow them. And so one of the helicopters follows us up the hill, probably follows us for several miles, you know, while the other one's hovered over the house, and then the other one's sort of scouring the hillside around the house looking for products. So, you know, that was a pretty typical experience.
Continuing our focus on the early years of cannabis cultivation in Humboldt County, here's local singer-songwriter and longtime SoHum resident Anna Hamilton describing her introduction to the industry.
So when I ran away, I drove up here, and it was in October. I just drove right up to the place somehow, up Sealy Creek Road, which was about to be closed because it would close every winter because there would be a giant landslide. And I get up there, and I had driven too far, and I ended up right in the driveway. And out of the bushes, one of the guys that I'd met on my vacation comes along, and he's pulling like an 18-foot-long marijuana plant. And it was the first time I'd ever seen a full-grown marijuana plant. And I get out of my car and say, hi, so-and-so. Hey, that thing's getting mud on it. You need some help? And he goes, yeah, you want to help me? And that was the beginning of my career.
Uh-huh.
And I got a clipping job. And the second clipping job I got was with 30 women. A guy hired women because they were easier to handle. And he had a big Visqueen greenhouse. And we were clipping weed in there when camp came. And so 30 women and all of the grower guys and the diggers and the processor guys and the owner and all that, we all had a run. Well, nobody could bring their cars up because nobody wanted cars on the property. It's a dead giveaway to the cops, and it's also the neighbors hate it because all the traffic on the roads. And then the guys take their money down to the city and get drunk and don't come back. So we didn't get paid, and we couldn't have our car. So I got a ride with about 15 people on the frame, nothing but steering wheel, engine, and four tires and a frame of a power wagon down Elk Ridge Road, picking up hippie trimmers as we jumped out of the bushes and jumped onto this
running
car.
Running from camp.
And then we got down to the bottom of the road in the classic cluster of all the neighbors down at the bottom of each dirt road. And as you drove to town, you'd come down to the, you know, the different creeks where they met the road, and you'd see these clusters of people at the dirt road turnouts.
But camp wasn't the only danger growers faced in those days. Once again, here's Hezekiah Allen.
You know, back then, somebody would break into your home with an assault rifle, tie you up, and take everything you had, and you would, you know, grin and bear it and pick your head up. And, you know, back then, the violent crime that happened within the grower community was largely unreported, and there wasn't a lot we could do about it. And so we lived in fear of that more nefarious criminal element as well, because we didn't have law enforcement or the rest of civil society to rely on when those types of crimes took place. Because the judicial system viewed what we were doing as equivalently bad to what these violent criminals were doing.
That's just a quick look at the foundation of the cannabis industry in the early days. Those clips come from the first two episodes of the Humboldt Chronicles. And you can listen to the full episodes online at 941lounge.com. We're going to take a quick break right now, but when we come back, we'll revisit a mystery involving big money, puzzling, interlocking corporations, lawyers, and patents. You're listening to the Humboldt Chronicles. Welcome back to the Humboldt Chronicles, and thank you for listening. If you're just joining us, this month we're taking a look back at some of the past episodes of the Humboldt Chronicles. And in April of last year, we explored a very interesting but also very hazy situation involving what are called utility patents that a mysterious company had applied to cannabis. Here's host Chuck Rogers explaining the situation.
What we have here is a mystery on our hands. The plot includes lawyers, pot, money, anxiety, and we pick up the story right next door to us in Nevada. A reporter who covers cannabis issues is there and encounters a soft-spoken yet intense biologist, a PhD researcher, in fact, named after a Jungle Book character, Mowgli. He's sleep-deprived because he's worried, concerned about a few somewhat hazy, secretive companies with millions of dollars seeking control of the marijuana industry early on by patenting nearly everything in sight. The implications, he tells the reporter, are immeasurable and could force some small operators out of business and maybe even impede medical research. Hearing all of this is reporter Amanda Chicago Lewis, who is an investigative journalist and a columnist for Rolling Stone magazine based in Los Angeles. Producer Larry Trask and I spoke with her by phone recently.
Las Vegas, November of 2016. Amanda Chicago Lewis is at the Marijuana Business Daily conference there. While there, she meets biologist Mowgli Holmes, who runs a research lab in Portland. He said there was a story he wanted to tell her about, and that it was a story that needed attention and some unraveling.
He told me about the existence of these wide-ranging cannabis plant patents that covered huge swaths of genetic variation that had already been filed and approved, some of them in the United States, some of them internationally, more patents pending.
Lewis comes away from the conversation thinking this is not going to be easy. She starts by confirming the legitimacy of what Holmes had just told her.
And so from there, I spent some time just trying to investigate exactly who these people were behind these patents, how legitimate were their legal claims to the patents, and what had really happened here and what did it mean.
She kept running into the name Gary Hiller of Phytex and Biotech Institute, known to be interested in biotechnology and nutrition research. Hiller is also a lawyer with work experience in technological innovation and intellectual property issues.
I found, at least a dozen companies that were affiliated with Gary Hiller. It was sort of like there were known quantities and they were all kind of floating around and it was unclear who was involved with the actual patents and who was maybe just part of this constellation of people. And then the real question for me was, where is the money coming from? Because that sort of would tell me who actually owns the patents, right? There's a lot of fear in the cannabis industry around these sort of secret potential corporate takeovers. A lot of rumors about Philip Morris and Monsanto and other really big companies that allegedly have secret cannabis plans in place. And people are pretty nervous about that. And of course, those companies do have a pretty big incentive to keep it secret. So the question was, like, would I be able to trace this back to some major mainstream company that quietly was buying up these patents?
Following the money, she found a lead, but not necessarily a final answer.
I did find that a person who seemed to be financially bankrolling a lot of Gary Hiller's activities is this Iranian man named Sean Sedegat, whose family's fortune came from cosmetics packaging. And there was a lot of evidence pointing toward his potential involvement in the patents, though he, I'm pretty sure, denies that he was involved in the patents specifically. So it's all very complicated, and lots of people have reasons to be secretive.
Concerns around this issue run the gamut. Consolidation of patents into just a few hands, the potential for encumbering medical research, and the expansive nature of some of the patents.
You know, it's very broad. This is why Mowgli was so concerned about it and wanted to talk to me about it, because one patent covers something like any plant with more than 3% THC, more than 3% CBD, and like no myrcene. Basically, the patents are not on individual strains. They're on like cannabinoid and terpene profiles that are incredibly broad and cover hundreds and hundreds of strains. In terms of like, what are we potentially missing out on if one company actually does begin enforcing these patents and saying that other people are not allowed to breed or research or experiment in any way with the plants that they have patented, we could be missing out on the greatest potential medical revolution of the 21st century, you know, because if we actually put the money and the laws behind doing research into the, frankly, like pretty amazing things that cannabis can do that could change healthcare globally.
Of course, an unavoidable question when dealing with this issue is whether there are parallels with the Monsanto situation, where giant agribusinesses own thousands of patents on technology, seeds, plants, chemicals, machinery.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the real fear. The crazy thing about Monsanto and what happened right in the agriculture industry is that it went from genetically modified plants, which were like, okay, yeah, you did spend a lot of money to create that, to just any plant. Just like the flexibility on being able to say this was pre-existing in nature, but it was a very specific variety, and I was the first person to like bring it to the patent office, so I own it. That's just a really slippery slope. There's good arguments for and against the idea that patents stifle innovation or that they promote innovation. You know, it's sort of, it's more complicated than just all patents are bad or all patents are good, but it's putting cannabis in the position of going in the same direction as corn and things like that. However, there's this vibrant industry that already exists and has existed for years and years and years. It just had to operate in the shadows. And so that complicates public domain in what I think is a unique way.
So these patents, as we heard, could potentially pose a huge problem for Humboldt's cannabis industry. But are the patents even valid? That's a tough question, and it turns in part on what's called prior art. You can't patent something that's not new, something everybody already knows about. But if cannabis has been around for thousands of years, how can it be patented? To get some clarity on that topic, we spoke with Dale Hunt, partner and patent attorney at Hahn, Loser & Parks.
The whole public policy of the patent system is that if you invented something and you really have something new, you should be able to protect that in exchange for disclosing it to the public and eventually letting it go into the public domain at the end of your monopoly. But if what you're claiming to have invented is already in the public domain, you shouldn't be able to pull it back out of the public domain and have a monopoly on it. So the patent examiner's role is to basically protect what's in the public domain from being taken out of it. So they look to the whole universe of prior art, patent literature, academic literature, sales brochures, anything. They search the entire universe of accessible information to see if what you're claiming is new or not. So you apply that to cannabis, and you've got a big problem. Because what academic literature is there on cannabis? What patent literature is there on cannabis? The examiner has to look at what you're alleging is new, but you've got this almost complete lack of any kind of searchable information about what was in the prior art. Because while there was probably all kinds of commercial activity and all kinds of creative activity in the world of cannabis, there's almost no record of any of it. It's a problem. It's a unique problem. It may well be a temporary problem, but it's a problem. How in the world is a patent examiner supposed to know whether something is new or not?
Host Chuck Rogers spoke with Nat Pennington, CEO of Humboldt Seed Company, about the potential impact of the patents on his business.
These utility patents that we're talking about here, how might they impact the seed business? And tell me what you have going on down the road here.
It's definitely concerning, especially just being that, you know, to reiterate, the prohibition of cannabis has left this sort of vacuum of what we call prior art,
right,
or existing cannabis varieties.
And it's kind of a unique situation in the law.
It is. It's really unique. And what I think is obvious is that cannabis is something that people have had a relationship with for, you know, time immemorial.
10,000 years or so?
Sure. I mean, there's,
at least,
you know, evidence of
about 8,000.
Oh, there you go.
Robert Clark.
See? 8,000.
Yeah.
That's long enough.
Yeah.
That works.
Long enough. Yeah, exactly.
Shouldn't that be considered prior art?
You would think.
Yeah.
And that's certainly, I think, just the kind of hard evidence. But, you know, we can all sort of hypothesize that it's basically, it's been a part of us since kind of the beginning. And, so because of that, I think the idea of slapping a broad patent to, you know, somebody like me and really a lot of community members in Humboldt County that would prevent us from doing maybe, you know, what we've been doing for so long, or things that we may have been even a part of developing and and helping to bring into fruition, having that kind of taken away, and you know, that's a tough pill to swallow when we think of those kinds of an idea.
The voice you heard chiming in during that segment belongs to Beth Schechter, who's the executive director of the Open Cannabis Project, an organization seeking to protect cannabis strains from hostile patent activity. In this segment, Chuck and Beth look to the future and try to find a reason to be optimistic.
And Beth, following up on that, and going all the way back to what Amanda Chicago Lewis was saying earlier in the show, where she discovered floors full of lawyers in Los Angeles, thus the need for support for organizations like Open Cannabis Project. You're optimistic, though. I can hear that in your voice.
Oh, yeah. I'm totally optimistic. I mean, one, I haven't seen these guys act yet. I don't know what they're going to do. But I know that they've spent a lot of money on this. And at the same time, like, we will just see. The truth is, I mean, the truth, the capital T truth, is that the claims that they are making, that the claims that are in Biotech Institute LLC patents that are being referred to, the claims that are being made refer to plants that were in the public domain prior to the issue of the patents, period.
Right.
Cannabis and the community and the economic situation that we've had to work within because of prohibition is different from other plants, period. So we'll see what happens, but as far as I'm concerned, the truth is on our side. And, you know, I know that that doesn't always work in the eyes of the law in the short term, but I'm hoping that in the long term that it will. And I'm going to do everything that I can in my power to prevent future patents like these, and then we'll see what happens with this one in the future. And I have a feeling that this community will come together and work everything that they can to protect themselves and the work that they've rightfully done for the past however many generations.
The mystery surrounding these patents has yet to fully unfold, but it's a fascinating story. One we can only touch upon here. To listen to the full story, check out the April edition of the Humboldt Chronicles, which you can find at 941lounge.com. We're going to let our wonderful sponsors get a few words in, but when we come back, we're going to be talking about the value of the Humboldt brand. Back in a moment on the Humboldt Chronicles. Welcome back to the Humboldt Chronicles, and thank you very much for listening. In this segment, we're going to be talking about branding. Making products behind the Redwood Curtain is expensive. More expensive than it is in areas in which proximate markets are substantially larger and in which transportation is more easily and readily available. So Humboldt-made products are going to come at a premium compared to the competition and will therefore have to somehow justify the premium price. In the cannabis world, we have a built-in advantage. The word Humboldt. Humboldt's known the world over as the producer of the highest quality cannabis. But just how valuable is the Humboldt brand? In our show from June of this year, we asked that very question.
What we want to do in the next hour is test conventional wisdom, which holds that the Humboldt name, the Humboldt brand, in and of itself will ensure the success of this area's cannabis industry and continue the economic support for the area that the black market industry provided for so long. And it might do just that. On the other hand, is there a danger in taking for granted the commercial power of the Humboldt brand in a legal market that promises more and more and more competition? So one of the questions is, how much do we rely on or gamble on our past notoriety? So, Larry, that's a good question, and it's difficult to answer, but we're going to take a shot at it.
We're going to give it a try. It is a difficult question to answer. I mean, I think the reason that we first started thinking about this was it came from the realization that even people who don't exactly know where Humboldt County is know the name Humboldt County and know its association with cannabis, and not just as a producer, but as a producer of quality cannabis.
And quality, as we're going to find out in this hour, is a key, right?
That's what we're gonna find out, yeah. And so the question was, how much of a value is there to the Humboldt County brand?
And how do you maintain that value?
Exactly.
Figure out what the value is and then be very, very careful to maintain it. So we're going to talk with some folks near and far about the Humboldt brand. We're going to hear from some local companies that have made a splash outside this area. And we're going to go down to the Los Angeles area to talk with somebody with no economic ties to Humboldt, but who does advise those in the cannabis business. So let's start to get some perspective here and try to figure this out. Who are we going to go to first?
Well, you know, since the cannabis industry, at least the legal cannabis industry, is so new, we thought that we'd start with some non-cannabis companies, some local producers who have been successful in getting their products beyond the Redwood Curtain. So we're going to start with Mary Keene. Have you ever had a Cypress Grove chef?
I was just going to say, I'm one of those people who did not like goat cheese, ever, until I tasted Humboldt Fog. And I found out that I'm not alone in that. There are people out there who have had it in their mind, maybe one bad experience or whatever it was, that they didn't like goat cheese. And then they went somewhere to dinner or somebody gave them some Humboldt Fog, and lo and behold, they're goat cheese fans. So, yeah, we're going to talk with Mary Keene of Cypress Grove Chev, goat cheese, Humboldt Fog, real goats in a real field around here. Success, yes, but the product comes at a premium cost.
In Humboldt County, I think we recognize that. I think people have realized that we have higher costs of production here. So bringing raw materials in and out of the county is more expensive, and finished goods in and out. Like, we have to ship on a small truck, and a small refrigerated truck is a rare commodity these days. So we have to ship to the Bay Area, offload it onto a bigger truck, which is what goes across. And that adds, you know, a fair amount of cost because you pay for an overnight storage. So I don't know so much if the world recognizes Humboldt as a producer of really quality goods, but I agree with you that it very much is. I mean, there's a lot of really fine products produced here, but I think to succeed in a marketplace outside of Humboldt, you have to be really good because you're going to be at a premium price point.
In a lot of industries, transportation and the added cost from here to other markets is a huge issue. It makes the end product more expensive.
And that's a key driver of all of this. I mean, the realization is that it just does cost more to produce products up here in Humboldt County for various reasons, transportation certainly being one of them.
Yeah.
And so your products are going to have to command a premium price.
Right. And so how do you convince the end consumer and maybe the retailer as well to put into their inventory to buy from here something that's more expensive? It has to be known as a higher quality.
But once you get outside the Redwood Curtain, that brings up a host of other issues.
It does. And Cypress Grove, not the only one who's figured that out. You went and talked with Briar Bush at Lost Coast Brewery. That's another local company that has made success by getting their product into larger markets outside of the Humboldt County area. And they've been doing well for a long time now.
Yeah, we've grappled with that one for a lot of years, and I grappled with that with another food company that I was with up here back in the 90s. It's a challenge. It's not as challenging to our industry as it would be to perhaps somebody making something that's kind of less value compared to the weight. We think we've got the right metrics where there's enough perceived value along with our labeling and our marketing and everything else where we could push out that cost structure. And besides, trucking logistics is only one nominal cost structure that you're up against. So as long as it's not disproportionate, we handle it just fine. And again, the consumer, they're more interested in this perception that they're purchasing something that is remote. So I think they do understand that it's going to come at a premium. And these demographic groups are willing to pay that premium to experience liquid beer, etc., food products that are produced in other regions. So I think you just have to identify it as part of your marketing plan as to how it is that you're going to address the additional costing and just make sure that that perception is always out there to the consumer.
There's also the fact that legalization in this state allows large-scale production virtually anywhere, not just in Humboldt. Warehouse production in Los Angeles, we hear about a lot. Large acreage production on farmland just about anywhere. As an example, Larry, you and I have been sent information about a farming collective with access to huge acreage between the Bay Area and the Salinas and Stockton areas. And so the question comes about with that kind of competition out there. Are we set up here such that our farmers can compete? Here's Mary Keene again.
I don't know what's going to happen with all the next year, probably, while things settle out with the legalities. I think I'm on the Humboldt Area Foundation board, and we went to Southern Humboldt, and the businesses there are down 50% to 70%. And my concern is that the tax structure is really going to force a lot of the boutique cannabis folks out of business because it wasn't arranged for anything other than huge. It really is frightening to me. But if what the goal was to, you know, and I'm not that knowledgeable in this field, but if the goal is to produce the Napa of the cannabis industry here, I think we're set up to miss the mark with the way the taxation and the, you know, how they've got to do samples from every batch. So if you're, it's one of the reasons our goat cheese is so expensive. So our batch is so small compared to a cow milk company that our costs of sampling are high as a percentage. So if you're a small cannabis producer and your cost of sampling is $1,000 and you have a small harvest, but somebody is doing a huge indoor grow and they have that same cost, that's hard. And I think we missed the mark.
To tee up the next part of our discussion, we want to go down to the Los Angeles area to talk with Joshua Kappel. He's a partner with Vicente Cederberg, which is a national law firm representing individuals and businesses in the cannabis industry. We wanted to talk about the strength of the Humboldt brand with someone who was not from here and find out what recommendations we might get as to keeping the brand strong and viable in a much more competitive market. First, Josh recommends self-policing, which is to say, adhering to local standards of production in order to keep the name Humboldt associated with quality.
And making sure that those who use the Humboldt name are growing and selling the best cannabis that's out there, or whatever, you know, maybe it's pesticide-free, or maybe it's mildew or mold-free, you know, whatever the standards as a community you guys come to appreciate with the Humboldt brand, you have to be diligent in protecting it. And, you know, and one business that's selling Humboldt branded cannabis that is very sub-quality will just bring down the brand for everyone. And, you know, and so I think there is a level of self-policing. I think there's a level of working together to create standards and Appalachian standards of what quality of product you have to have before you use this brand. So that's sort of part one on the internal piece. And then part two on the external piece, you know, like when you look at Napa Valley when it comes to wine, we look at Champagne, France, and you look at these, you know, they come together and engage in collective marketing. You know, and so it's like if you're part of, you know, a Humboldt County, you know, branding alliance, you know, engaging collective marketing in Southern California to push the brand as a whole, you know, could definitely, you know, could be something, you know, that increases brand value. I mean, you know, there's also a lot that's going on with different, you know, with different co-ops and collectives in the area. And I think, you know, support, you know, joining them and supporting them and also, you know, pushing a brand through them as well can also help you, you know, engage in this collective marketing. So in short, one is making sure the product remains the best, and then two, making sure the world knows that it's the best.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting that you mentioned Napa in there. As you might imagine, you probably know, a lot of discussion around here leading up to legalization, and certainly since, has involved the idea that Humboldt will become the Napa of cannabis, which certainly could happen. Now, there are a couple of issues there. One, Napa wineries can ship a case of wine to Wichita or to Nashville. Humboldt County pot growers can't do that.
Right.
Right now, those of us in this area who are interested in this are restricted to the California market, which is substantial, as we know, but it's still not the whole nation. So is there a chance that we could overestimate the value of the Humboldt brand here? And what I'm getting at there is, before legalization, this product pumped billions of dollars into this region, not just our county, but several counties in this region. The challenge now is to replace that money somehow into our local economy. And a lot of people are putting a lot of eggs in the county becoming the Napa of cannabis basket. What's your view of that?
If you look at the cannabis market right now, I don't think the cannabis consumer has quite figured out what they like the best yet in a legal and regulated market. And we haven't developed ways for people to use cannabis socially. So there hasn't been the social experiment of the social marketing aspect of, oh, no, this is the best, or try this or try that. So, you know, I do think that there's, you know, there is a lack of brand loyalty in some cases. Now, don't get me wrong. There is a number of people who I know who are diehard, you know, brand enthusiasts about certain cannabis products. But I think that the in general, the cannabis market is still being made, you know, and it's still being shifted. And, you know, and so there, you know, there is a risk that if Humboldt doesn't remain on top and doesn't engage in collective marketing and doesn't have strong brand standards, you know, that the brand could devalue, you know, and that there could be a region in, you know, in Europe, that, you know, and maybe it's Albania that grows the next best weed, or, you know, it's like, you know, who really knows when you look at this from a global perspective in an industry that's just beginning, you know, a legal industry that's just beginning, an industry where true marketing dollars haven't been spent yet. So there is a risk.
You make such a good point there. When you talk about collective marketing and tying it into the fact that there are other people who could grow high quality cannabis. And here's the thing, the equipment is available for that. The knowledge is out there. And we keep reading that there are people in your part of the state that are, you know, that are buying 50,000 square foot warehouses and getting ready to go into an industrial level production with pretty high quality cannabis. So you're collective marketing idea, tell me if I'm right or wrong, you think that that's crucial for our area. Is that right?
I do think it's crucial, and it's the story told, you know, and so it's the growers in LA will say, oh no, LA warehouse weed is the best. And the cultivators up in Humboldt will say, you know, the outdoor and sun-grown Humboldt weed in our ultra-rich soil by the coast is the best. And I think it's just part of the story, you know, that needs to get out there. And if everyone in Southern California is only hearing that LA warehouse weed is the best, whether or not that's true, that's all they're going to be hearing. And so if you're not collective marketing, if you're not, you know, if you're not telling the Humboldt story, you know, then consumers just won't have, they won't be able to make an educated choice. You know, and I also think there's a question too of, you know, it's like, you know, with Humboldt, you know, do you, you know, is it more of an Emerald Triangle collective marketing campaign, or do you focus just on Humboldt County? That's sort of a more of a question for you guys' community.
Again, that's Joshua Kappel. He's a partner with Vicente Cederberg, national law firm representing individuals and businesses in the cannabis industry. In competitive situations, I'm a big proponent, and a lot of people are, of finding ways to turn negatives into positives. Now, relative to the cannabis issue, we know that at least some people outside this area have a negative view of Humboldt. So what I'm wondering is whether there's a chance to turn what used to be negative perceptions of our area into positive perceptions as the legal market expands and continues to expand. Let's go back now to Briar Bush at Lost Coast Brewery.
Well, I suspect the regulation that's being applied to the industry today is going to be some sort of a cleansing process to, yeah, maybe, you know, break up some of that to some degree. And, you know, let's let's hope that it's all for the positive. I want everybody to have an opportunity to make their livelihood the way that they see fit, and that is partially what makes us who we are. So I'm not advocating one direction or the other, but yes, I do think that there will be some degree of evolution as to how they look at this county and what it is that comes out of here. However, at the same time, you go Colorado and these other states that are legalized and growing and doing so in mass production is only going to foster kind of a more open mindset to, the direction that the world is headed. And yeah, we might have been looked at as being rogue back years ago and teased. However, we were leaders.
It occurs to me that, yes, there is a connection in a lot of people's minds between Humboldt and cannabis. Mm-hmm. But going back to something I said earlier, it's not just cannabis. It's quality cannabis.
Right.
And these companies that are successful getting their non-cannabis products outside compete on the basis of quality. So if you could have some sort of magic, marketing plan that just worked exactly the way you wanted it to, mm-hmm. what you would do, it seems to me, is not focus on the specific product, but just try to build an impression on people's minds that if it comes out of Humboldt, it's quality, whether it's cheese or beer or cannabis. Humboldt means quality,
mm-hmm.
And that's an interesting and perhaps overly ambitious marketing effort.
There are a lot of lessons to be learned from regions with products that have done exactly what these folks are talking about in the past, and they've been successful. It's just that we have to get on board with that and make sure that that collective marketing gets done.
Those are some clips from our June edition of the Humboldt Chronicles. You can listen to the entire episode at 941lounge.com. This edition of the Humboldt Chronicles will be posted there soon and also at lostcoastoutpost.com and at iTunes for listening and downloading. This program is only possible because of our sponsors, so we say a big word of thanks to Eco Groovy Deals in Arcata, Satori Wellness, Sensa Valley, Humboldt Patient Resource Center, Heart of Humboldt, and the Humboldt County Collective. We'll be back with the Humboldt Chronicles at 6 p.m. on the third Wednesday of each month, so see you next year, January 16th at 6 p.m. On behalf of myself and host Chuck Rogers, thanks for listening and have a great night.